Okay, so what I'd like to spend part of my time talking about is some generalities, because we had a very nice explanation by Nick Reed in the previous talk about a particular topological phase of matter, which could be realized in paired superfluids with chiral pairing symmetry. And I'd like to spend a little time just talking about more general context for that, and including a little bit of mention of some motivation. So what is a topological phase? Well, roughly, it's a state of matter that has an energy gap above the ground state, and the quasi-particle excitations are anions. Okay, so that's kind of a rough definition that underlies a lot of motivation of, you know, thinking about these states. A little more precise definition would be it's a state of matter in which all measurable correlation functions are invariant under smooth deformations of the space-time manifold in which the system lives, which is kind of the active sense of a transformation. Or, in a more passive sense, it's independent of the choice of space-time coordinates, up to corrections that are very small, in exponentially small, let's say, in the energy gap of the system as the temperature gets small, or in some correlation length as the size of the system and as the distances between all the particles get large. Okay. Now, to give you a couple examples of that, the canonical example that we have from nature, fractional quantum Hall states. Here, as mentioned in kind of that first rough definition, we have quasi-particles here, which are fractionally charged and are anions. From the point of view of correlation functions, really the interesting one here is a current-current correlation function, which gives you the Hall conductance or Hall conductivity. And that correlation function, you'll notice that unlike in many correlation functions that you may see in physics, the metric tensor never appears in this because the fully antisymmetric epsilon symbol does. And that's one of the manifestations of the fact that this is a topologically ordered state. Okay. The example we had this morning, chiral superconductors. Well, in a chiral superconductor, the vortices in the superconductor are anions, which, as discussed in Nick's talk, in the case in which the pairing symmetry is P plus IP, the vortices are non-abelian anions. If instead you had a D plus ID superconductor instead, you would have abelian anionic vortices. So these are kind of two examples. I'll also give you some examples to kind of draw a line under it, which are not topological phases. In general, a superfluid or Bose-Einstein condensated bosons is not in general in a topological phase. Superfluid is some broken symmetry phase. A magnetically ordered state, okay, is not in general a topological phase. That's also some broken symmetry phase. However, it is possible for a topological phase to coexist with broken symmetry. They're really two separate phenomena, although in some particular model they may occur together. So a P plus IP superconductor is both a superfluid and it's in a topological phase. But really, although in a particular model those two may occur together, there's really two distinct phenomena. Similarly, a quantum Hall ferromagnet, in which you have ferromagnetic alignment of the spins in a quantum Hall state, that also is a broken symmetry which is occurring in that particular model, occurs together with the quantum Hall effect, but really is a distinct independent phenomenon. Okay. So although many examples we talk about have both of these, really kind of two distinct things, and in general it's not the case that a topological phase would have anything to do with broken symmetry. Okay. Now, in that first definition I gave you, I mentioned that, you know, kind of up front that, you know, one of the important aspects of a topological phase is that it has quasi-particles which are anions. So in particular, in a topological phase, when a particle is moved around, okay, because of the topological invariance, all that can happen is the ground state can pick up some phase if it's a non-degenerate ground state, and all that can depend on is how it winds around the other particles, and not in any way on the details of how it does so. If the ground state is degenerate with that number of quasi-particles, then it could be more than just a phase, but some non-trivial rotation in that degenerate space. Another manifestation of topological phases that, which is perhaps not so very interesting from the point of view of experiments, but is quite useful in theory and in numerics, is that if the system is put on a topologically non-trivial surface, such as a torus, either in its manifestation as a coffee cup or as a donut, that the ground state degeneracy, again, can only depend on the topology, and would be the same in either of these cases.
Okay.
Indeed, those two things are related. Fractional quasiparticles, even if the underlying constituents of the system, which may be electrons or cold atoms, have, let's say, periodic boundary conditions on the torus, the fractional quasiparticles need not. And their different boundary conditions are related to those different degenerate ground states. By changing fluxes through the handles, let's say, in a torus, you change those quasiparticle boundary conditions, which is, in many cases, equivalent to creating a quasiparticle quasi-hole pair, taking them around one generator of the torus and annihilating them. And that, in turn, is related to the effect of linking trajectories of two of these quasiparticles. Okay? So ground state degeneracy on the torus is part of the same complex of relations as quasiparticle grading statistics, although one or another may be, the former may be more easily probed in experiments, and the latter perhaps in numerics. And in this case, if you were to cut open the torus, you would then have an annulus, and the different ground states in the torus correspond to basically different quasiparticles that you might have at the inner and compensating on the outer boundary of the annulus. Okay. So the braiding of these quasiparticles is summarized most compactly by the particular representation of the braid group, which is realized on the n-particle Hilbert space. So these are the defining relations for the generators of the braid group, where, let's say, sigma I is a counterclockwise exchange of the ith and ith plus one particle, if you just put down some arbitrary ordering for the quasiparticles. They commute if I and j are greater, I minus j is greater than or equal to 2, which is to say they commute if they don't involve the same particle. And the following sequence of moves is the same done in either order, essentially, sometimes called the Young-Baxter equation. So this is an algebraic way of representing pictures like this, where this is one of these primitive exchanges. And this algebra is represented on the n-particle Hilbert space, depending on how it is, that determines the braiding statistics of the quasiparticle. The 1D representations of the braid group are all abelian, okay, and that corresponds to abelian anions, such as we believe are realized at the one-third quantum Hall state. The higher dimensional representations are non-abelian, and in those, the effect on Hilbert space of two braids like this, which are different, you can see topologically these are two different things, which is a manifestation of the fact that I've done these two braids in different orders here. The higher dimensional representations, if they're irreducible, must be non-abelian. Okay. Now, you'll notice that in order to have a higher dimensional representation, of course, you need to have a higher dimensional Hilbert space, or in other words, you need some degeneracy of the n-particle Hilbert space, even with fixed positions of those n particles. Okay. So that latter situation is a situation in which you have a non-abelian topological state, so a particular type of topological state. When you have n quasiparticles at fixed positions, there's an exponentially large set of degenerate states, which I may label A as 1 up to G, states psi A. And if I take two of these quasiparticles here and exchange them, like so, in a counterclockwise manner, then the state, a given initial state in that degenerate space, will transform into a different one, which I can parameterize by some matrix M. On the other hand, if I braided particle J with some other particle K, I might pick up a different matrix N, which need not commute with M. Okay? So this is the sense in which the statistics, the braiding statistics of these particles is non-abelian. Okay. Another important concept here, in addition to braiding, is fusion, which is essentially is just a statement that if you have two quasiparticles which have their quantum numbers, their particular topological properties, and you bring them much closer together than any of the other particles in the system, or any of the other quasiparticles in the system, then they just look like, essentially like a single quasiparticle with the quantum numbers combined of the two in a particular way. Okay? Now, the way in which that happens isn't necessarily just addition, as it would be with electrical charge, where you take two charged one objects, and from far away it looks like a single charged two object. They can combine in multiple ways, as is the case with which you're already familiar of spin, in which you take two spin half objects, you combine them, you might get a spin zero object or a spin one object. And those are two, in the case of spin, that's a way of breaking up the four possible states here. Well, in the case of anions, similar kinds of effects can happen. Two anions can combine, and they can form a linear combination of other types of anions. Okay. And in the non-abelian case, the different degenerate states that you have in the system with n of these anions can be understood in terms of the different fusion channels. That roughly speaking, in the anionic analog of this, you might have two of these particles, and they can either end up in one of these two different states, which is like two spin halves either forming a singlet or triplet. Okay. So if I re-express everything that Nick said, or not everything, if I re-express some of the results that Nick gave in his talk this language as an example of the abstract statements I just made, Nick was talking about the case of a chiral P-wave superconductor. And as he pointed out, in its essential features, if you ignore some abelian phases, is basically the same as the state that we believe is realized, although don't know for certain, believe is realized at Hall conductance 5 halves, the 5 halves quantum Hall, fractional quantum Hall state. And in more abstract language, is related to what's sometimes called the Ising TQFT, or topological quantum field theory, or SU2 level 2 Chern-Simons theory, which are not exactly the same, again, because of some abelian phases that are not particularly important here. Well, the fusion rules in kind of Ising model language here is that you basically have three types of particles. You have a sigma particle, which is kind of the fundamental, in a sense, particle in this theory. The psi, which is basically is that vortex that Nick was talking about. You have a psi, which is the neutral fermion that whose presence or absence Nick was driving through the Bogdanov-Degen equations, and you have one, which is just the vacuum. Now, ordinarily, you wouldn't think of the vacuum as a particle, but for all of the accounting that we do here, it's quite useful to think of the absence of a particle as being a particular trivial type of particle. Okay. And so the fusion rules here are that if you take two of these psi particles, you get one. Again, that may correlate somewhat with your intuition. If you take two fermions, that makes essentially a Cooper pair. And since Cooper pairs are condensed in the ground state, it's as good as having no Cooper pair at all, or infinitely many Cooper pairs. So that's like a one. The really non-trivial one here is that if you take two of these sigmas, meaning two of these vortices, you fuse them together, you could either get vacuum quantum numbers or have an extra fermion left over. And a language of, in the language of SU2 at level 2, Kac-Moody algebra or Chern-Simons theory or related quantum group representations, these all correlate one-to-one to the fact that if you take two spin-a-half representations, you can either get the singlet or triplet with spin 0 or spin 1. However, unlike in ordinary SU2, there's kind of an upper cutoff here at 1, so that if you take a 1/2 and a 1, you can only get 1/2. There's no 3/2 here. And if you take 1 times 1, you can only get 0. You can't get 1 or 2. Okay. The degeneracy is of if you have 2n of these sigmas, or j equals a half quasiparticles, it's 2 to the n minus 1 states, which basically are the representation space for that Clifford algebra of gamma matrices, anti-commuting matrices that square to 1. And the interesting thing about this degeneracy is that it's square root of 2 states per quasiparticle, or in other words, 2 states for every pair of these quasiparticles. Why 2 for every pair? Well, it's coming out of the fact that every time you fuse two of these quasiparticles, there's two possibilities that you can have. And it's essential, really, for what we're talking about here, that it really be a degeneracy of states that's associated with a collection of quasiparticles, not a degree of freedom associated with each one. Sometimes it's a little bit misleading that in this case it's still an integer. It looks almost like 2 to some power, but really you have to keep in mind it's really square root of 2 to a power here, and so that there isn't a way to identify a degree of freedom, a local degree of freedom with each of these quasi-particles. In fact, in some respects, a more interesting example is one in which when you have n of these quasi-particles around, the degeneracy is the nth Fibonacci number, and in that case, it looks like the golden mean to the number of particles, and it's even more dramatically the case there that it's not the n particle Hilbert space is not factorizing into a product of smaller Hilbert spaces. Okay. Yes?
I would have thought that some of this algebra, I don't know whether all the things will be obeyed by some of the classical defects, or some of the function by actually function on the boundary, which is one of the specific phrases that we discussed yesterday.
I mean, a classical algebra may obey something like some kind of fusion rules like this, but I don't see how it would give you, the braiding I have to talk about in a minute, so I don't see how it could give you the kind of braiding properties that I'm going to tell you. Okay. So the next thing is, of course, there's also braiding properties here, which is that now I exchange two of these particles, and the end result of the effect that that has on this Hilbert space here is the same as up to, again, some U1 phases that aren't particularly interesting, in the current context at least. It is essentially the same thing as doing a 90-degree rotation in the IJ plane in 2n-dimensional space. So if you remember, you have 2n quasi-particles, so you have essentially these 2n real fermionic variables. If I just notionally represented this by 2n-dimensional Cartesian space, then the effect on Hilbert space of doing a rotation of an exchange of the I and J particles is in fact just a rotation in that notional space, okay? Which shows you at once why it's not abelian, because these different rotations in different planes are not going to commute. It also shows you why this particular state has some limitations from the point of view of quantum computation, namely that all you're doing here is 90-degree rotations, and for quantum computation, you'd like to be able to perform arbitrary rotations. And that's why if this particular model, if it's realized in nature, if you'd like to use it for quantum computation, you would need to do something in addition to purely topological operations, or go to a different model, such as the Fibonacci one that I briefly mentioned. Now, so I've been talking about kind of abstractly, you know, what if you had a topological phase? Now the question is, you know, where do these things come from, or how might they emerge or arise? You know, if you look at the Hamiltonian of electrons in, let's say, in a solid or cold atoms in an optical lattice, you might have some particles, either electrons or atoms, and they can hop around, and they have, you know, some hopping parameters and some, let's say, repulsion, maybe on site, nearest neighbor, etc. You'll notice that this Hamiltonian here is clearly not topologically invariant, okay? At least for any realistic model. The Vijs are going to depend on the distance between I and J, and similarly the Ts. So if topological invariance is going to have anything to do with this Hamiltonian, it must be a symmetry which emerges at low energy, okay? So the low energy effective theory, the low energy description of the physicist model is far more symmetric than, would have to be far more symmetric than the microscopic model itself. Okay. Now, just to underscore the point, this is very much the opposite of something that we're very familiar with, which is spontaneous symmetry breaking, namely the case in which the low energy and long wavelength physics is less symmetrical than the microscopic equations of motion. Of course, that's the case in the superfluid, the case in this room. It doesn't look rotationally invariant, at least to me, but even though the underlying equations presumably are, even at very different scales, if you look at the cosmic microwave background, that's also not quite rotationally invariant, even if the underlying equation, the underlying microscopic theory is. But what we're really interested in here is actually the converse, namely the situation in which the low energy and log wavelength physics might be more symmetrical than the microscopic equations. So that's emergent symmetry. And topological phases of matter, if they're to occur in nature, are presumably an example of this phenomenon. Okay. To put this in slightly more formal language, which is not essential for the rest of what I'm saying, so if this doesn't sing to you, don't worry about it. A system is in a topological phase if its low energy effective field theory is a topological quantum field theory. In other words, if all its physical correlation functions are topological invariant. The classic example of this is Chern-Simons-Witten theory with the following action, okay, for a non-abelian gauge field. And since the metric doesn't appear in this action, you might expect it to be topological invariant. And in fact, a more careful quantum treatment shows that it is, even at the quantum level. And the question that we really, so this is kind of not yet another sort of formal definition of a topological phase. But the question that we really want to answer here, or at least try to get some understanding of, is where or how such a magical effective field theory as this could arise as the low energy limit of a complex system of, let's say, interacting electrons or cold atoms or whatever, which is not topologically invariant. Okay. Well, there's at least three places that one might think to look. One is the fractional quantum Hall regime. So this is two-dimensional electron gases and semiconductor devices. The good side of this is that we know that topological phases occur here. So here is a Hall trace and all of these plateaus in the Hall resistance where the longitudinal resistance is going to zero simultaneously. These are all places in which the electrons have organized themselves into a topological phase. On the other hand, the energy scales may be low, perhaps less than a Kelvin, which in this context at least is a low temperature scale, okay, relative to the natural scales in the problem. It's very highly dependent on your ability to produce high mobility gallium arsenide, on which there are very strong limitations at present. And given one of these topological phases, if you see a plateau like this, you know that the system is in a topological phase, but it's not so easy to directly determine which one it's in. Okay. Another place you might think to look are transition metal oxides. Why might you look there? Well, you know that there's lots of quote-unquote exotic phenomena there. You know you have high temperature superconductivity, colossal magnetic resistance, stripes, thermoelectricity. So if all this good stuff is happening, why not topological phases? And there are many, many experimental probes that can be brought to bear on transition metal oxides. You have transport, angle resolved photoemission, neutron and X-ray scattering, NMR, thermodynamics, etc. The downside is, unlike in the quantum Hall case, you don't know if there are topological phases. And these systems have rather complicated Hamiltonians with many competing effects. So, in fact, one of the virtues of these systems that they have all this interesting stuff is also, unfortunately, a disadvantage, namely that there are many competing effects. The Hamiltonians are complicated. You have electrons, ions, phonons, in-orbit coupling, et cetera, many complicated effects. And as a result of those complicated effects, you have many competing phases here. And what often seems to have happened is because these Hamiltonians describing these materials have in them these many competing effects, depending on what approximation you choose to study them with, you may see a rather different phase diagram. So it's difficult to untangle these materials. The situation that is probably of most interest to this audience, ultra-cold atoms in optical traps. Here, there's this great virtue that there's a rather high degree of control over the Hamiltonian of the system, certainly as compared to the other two cases. On the other hand, it's rather different types of experimental probes that one has compared to the semiconductor devices or transition metal oxides. Okay. Now, so that shows that this is going to be quite a difficult problem trying to find and identify a topological phase. But I want to point out that in addition to the fact that they're cool, there's also a little more practical reason for going to that trouble, which is that they have potential applications to quantum computing. So just as topology is some rather redundant way of encoding, or rather, just as local geometry is a rather redundant way of encoding topological information, that's analogous to something that one would like to do in quantum error correction, which is to encode some logical qubits rather redundantly in a much larger set of physical qubits so as to protect that information from corruption. And as Alexei Kataev pointed out, and I think he might say a little bit more in his talk later this morning, is that if a physical system were to have topological degrees of freedom, which are insensitive to local probes, in other words, if we were to have a topological phase and we were looking at the Hilbert space, the n multi-quasi-particle Hilbert space, then the information contained in them, in that Hilbert space, would be automatically protected against errors caused by local interactions with the environment. So how would that work? Well, your quantum memory, remember when you have n quasi-particles at fixed positions, you have an exponentially large set of degenerate states. In the case that in the example that I talked about, which is the example you heard a lot about from Nick this morning, that exponentially large is 2 to the n minus 1. If you have 2 n quasi-particles, you apply non-trivial unitary transformations to this quantum information by braiding, let's say, quasi-particles. And it turns out that for a large class of these states, as shown by Friedman, Larson, and Wang, that the braiding operations, unlike in the one example that I told you about, braiding operations are sufficient to implement all the unitary group to desired accuracy when you have enough quasi-particles in the system. So, in fact, this also answers a question which might have been slightly nagging you, which is whether topological protection would be too much of a good thing. And the answer is no, because of the fact that you can do, unlike the environment, or unlike the environment could do with any substantial probability, can do these topological operations just braiding so as to be able to access this information. Or, as an artist more fancifully has depicted it, in terms of braiding these strings like this, you'd like to create some non-abelian quasi-particles. That'll be your qubits. You could then measure their state, perhaps by an Aronoff-Bohm type of measurement, which I'll say a little bit more. That would be initialization. Braid the quasi-particles. That would be applying gates. And then read out by measuring the final state again. Okay. So topological quantum computation depends on two things, really. One is the existence and nature of non-abelian topological phases of matter. And secondly, the ability to braid the quasi-particle excitations of these, the anionic quasi-particle excitations of these phases. And what would you suppose is that you kind of want to settle this first, and then once you've decided that, you then move on and try to do this. But in fact, the opposite is true, which is that you really need to be able to braid quasi-particle excitations in order to settle this question. Okay. Let me give you a short example, which involves a little bit of digression to the quantum Hall effect, just to kind of emphasize what some of the issues are, some of the difficulties, and hopefully inspire people in the cold atom community to maybe think about similar types of experiments. So, as I mentioned, the 5-halves plateau is a strong candidate to be a non-abelian quantum Hall state. The Pfaffian or Moore-Reed state in particular is the one that we think it is. It has an effective field theory, which is precisely of the form that I mentioned, namely Chern-Simons-Witten theory for a particular, in this case, SU2 gauge group at a particular level, which is 2. And so this is, at present, the most likely place to find a non-abelian quantum Hall state, in the fractional quantum Hall regime, at least. And so various ways that you might probe this to try to determine if it's such a state, well, one thing you can do is put point contact. So this is a bird's eye view of a two-dimensional electron gas. The electrons are all moving around here. And you can gate such a system so as to increase or induce tunneling between the two edges of the system. And in such a case, when you have a point contact like this, quasi-particles can tunnel across. And as they do so, if you imagine lowering the temperature or the voltage, this tunneling, it turns out, gets stronger and stronger so that the system, in effect, breaks itself in two. Okay? And by studying this crossover, there are particular power laws associated with the resistance in both the high temperature and low temperature limits. The crossover turns out to be related to two-channel Kondo problem. And so a great deal of information can be learned and mapped onto theory if you can, in a detailed manner, study transport in this way, okay, a particular kind of transport. So one-point contact's a good thing. Two-point contact, so more is better, right? So two-point contacts enables you to have an interferometer, so that if you had two-point contact, you could consider interference between these two trajectories, which together, through their interference, contribute to, again, transport in this case. So with because you could, so this is sort of the interferometer of Chamoun et al. And in the regimes in which quasi-particle tunneling is dominated by the basic sigma quasi-particles, which in this case have a quarter of the electron charge, then it turns out that the interference between these two different types of trajectories gives a contribution like this to the longitudinal conductance. And as pointed out a while ago, that this is basically, the interference term is essentially a knot invariant associated with that particular theory, and in this case with the Jones polynomial for this particular length. And because of this, because this is a non-trivial matrix element, it's an element that matrix is not just a phase, so it's not something that we can compensate by other phases, which is a serious issue in trying to unravel these sorts of topological effects, is that there's both topological and dynamical phases, and you want to kind of disentangle them from each other. But in this case, that's not a problem. And as very recently shown by Stern and Halpern and Vonderson et al., and I think Alexei might talk about a little more in his talk, that when this particular matrix element was actually computed, it was found to be zero for any odd number of quasi-particles. And so there's a very dramatic even odd effect here that can't be hidden by, let's say, the Aronoff-Bohm effect. Okay. Now, measuring non-abelian braiding statistics is very closely related to actually performing an elementary quantum computation, because after all, what are you doing? You're taking a quantum state, performing an operation, and observing that it's changed non-trivially. And indeed, an interferometer contains almost everything you need. You've got qubits and a readout procedure. You just need to apply gates. Or if that's not enough motivation, then if one and two-point contacts were good, then three is even better. This now allows you to manipulate a qubit and measure it by the Aronoff-Bohm effect. So now we've got three of these point contacts and tunneling in all of these places, which again, this is bird's eye view of a two-dimensional electron gas here. And these two antidots are supposed to contain one quasi-particle or an odd number of quasi-particles each. So this is now a qubit. And what you would like to do with this qubit is, as before, do an interference experiment to measure it out. So this is basically, again, an electronic analog of a Fabry-Perot interferometer. And depending on the state of the qubit, you just get a different result in your interferometer, which in this case would be measured by measuring conductivity. Okay. But now you can also tunnel a quasi-particle in this manner, which is applying a sigma x or not gate to this. And as before, you get the same, a different result, even if you return all the other knobs to the same values. So these kinds of braiding and interference experiments allow you to manipulate and read out quasi-particles. And the expected error rate in this case, as I mentioned kind of in the first slide, the corrections to topological invariants are all very small because they're controlled basically by the gap. So if you can make the temperature very small and the gap very large, then you're in a regime where the underlying error rates are extremely small, maybe even lower than in this estimate. These are ongoing experiments in the fractured quantum Hall regime, but of course we don't know how they're going to turn out, and so it would be very useful to think about analogous sorts of things, perhaps in the cold atom context. Now, I don't know of anything quite analogous to transport at present, but perhaps something else might work as well, which is the following. Supposing you were trying to detect non-abelian anions in a cold atom system. Well, and let's suppose, just to be concrete, that we had a P plus IP superfluid state of cold atoms, such as Gerari, Victor, and Leo, and Anton Andreev suggested could occur in a system with a P-wave Feshbach resonance, as we'll hear about more in the next talk. Then, as Nick described, that if you had a P plus IP paired superfluid state of such cold atoms, then the vortices in such a superfluid would exhibit non-abelian braiding statistics. And if you could braid vortices, so if you knew some way to manipulate a vortex, play them around, and you had two end of those vortices, you'd apply some non-trivial transformation to this space. Now, I don't know how to do that, but let's imagine that that were done, and you wanted to now read out the vortices. Well, as if you recall back to the slide on fusion rules, well, when two of these vortices are brought together, there are two different fusion channels for this composite corresponding to the presence or absence of a fermion. Okay? And so one way that you can at least read out which state this pair of vortices is in is do some kind of braiding procedure, bring them close together, and then unlike in the electronic case, you have an extra degree of freedom here, which is that you have internal states of this fermion. And so what you would then do is to detect the presence or absence of that fermion, you might cycle through a transition to an excited state of a single unpaired atom, but which would not quite, you would not quite be able to do that with the paired atoms, which would be detuned by some small amount. Now, there's a little extra complication that you, of course, have to worry about whether this detuning is too small compared to the width of that resonance. So what you instead do is you Raman excite this to some other state, to a very narrow transition, and then cycle through to actually observe that unpaired fermion. And so this takes advantage of some extra possibilities that you have with cold atoms that you don't have with electrons to do something, although again, there's still the issue of how you would actually braid these things. Now, continuing in the same vein, I should mention that that particular scheme is special to that particular non-Abelian topological state where the two states can be understood as being, let's say, distinguished by the presence or absence of a neutral fermion. A more general possible approach, which Peter Zoller explained to me, actually, or explained the possibility of it to me, is that you might be able to take advantage of another feature of atomic systems, namely that you might be able to observe the real space distribution, kind of a snapshot of the atoms, and analyze the statistics of that snapshot. Now, it turns out that in a very large class of these non-Abelian topological states, there are various lattice models. We cooked up one with Mike Friedman and Kirill Stengel. There's a very beautiful one due to Levin and Wen and Stanley and Fradkin and further analysis by 5 minutes. Okay. By Fikovsky et al. That in many of these models, the emergent degrees of freedom are often loops or trivalent graphs. So it could be that the occupied sites form loops, or that you have some dimer model where the dimers on alternating sites form loops, or up spins on a lattice perhaps form loops. So a large number of these models end up mapping onto loop gases in which the wave functions satisfy various properties. As a result of the properties satisfied by, here's kind of loop gas wave functions, these are trivalent graphs. As a result of these properties, there's some statistical ensemble imposed on these ground state wave functions so that if you could actually observe that and analyze those statistics, which is something that right now with Matthias Troyer and Simon Treps is actually quite useful thing to do in numerical studies of such states, then that would be another way to get a handle, which, again, you wouldn't have as far as I could even imagine in any of the other incarnations of topological states. So just to summarize then, non-Abelian topological phases are a remarkable emergent phenomenon with potential applications to quantum computation. In order to detect such a phase, it would be essential to measure braiding and fusion properties. In the solid state context, you could hope to do this with transport and quantum interference. In the atomic gas context, you know, there's some advantages and disadvantages. There's some things you may not be able to do, but there's wholly different possibilities which you may be able to take advantage of.
So I think we've got time for a couple of quick questions. Anyone? Yeah.
So at the beginning of your talk, you mentioned the coexistence of breaking symmetry and topological phase. And also, I mean, the P-wave resonance is one example. So my question is about if we have, say, topological objects zero mode, zero energy mode, in compressible background, like in neutral superfluid, then even at a low temperature, there will be density modes, etc., coupled with it. Do we understand the whether the zero mode can still be immune from dephasing process, or they will couple with those low energy mode, just like a usual conventional qubit systems, which dephasing is always an issue.
So I think probably the final word on this isn't known, but my feeling is that in most cases, if you're worried about Goldstone mode, Goldstone modes typically are not a serious problem at low energies. They decouple in general from other degrees of freedom. They only have, and for instance, they only have derivative interactions. So I would think that while they could compute, they could, now as Nick pointed out, there's that tail in a superfluid. So I think that you certainly would worry about abelian phases being uncontrolled, but my feeling is that the non-abelian part probably is not going to be affected.
Quick question. If not, then let's thank you.